Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. And here comes Halloween. Our ancient festival as the world begins to die again. As it does at the tail end of every year, the leaves fall and decay, the green things wither, the sun hides away. And we remember the dead. Maybe on these chilly nights on the road to winter, the dead remember us. Simply because they have nothing else to do, if the schoolyard chant is correct. Thanks to everybody who journeyed out the Friday last for our Halloween time show at Hakumba Hot Springs. Down on the sinister border, an enormous metal wall and ditch of horror between the rich and poor. Cutting through those sun-blasted hills and valleys, forever patrolled by the heavily armed borderland forces. And yet the Hot Springs complex, with its little town and revitalized hotel and restaurant and carefully preserved old bathhouse ruins, that's all very beautiful. And that's always the state of things. So look among the garbage for the flowers, to paraphrase a poet who knew the score. And enjoy the soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Tonight's episode was supposed to be the recording of that show, but as happens about 75% of the time when I do a live event, the recording is unusable. Because of the kinds of problems that always arise when somebody is simply spread too thin. I cannot run a recording deck back there with the soundboard when I'm spinning tails on the stage, so it goes. That's the way of things. The best things, anyway, maybe they happen and that's that. No concert movie, no yellow and black vinyl box set, no nothing. I didn't even get a poster. They were done up real nice, kind of Old West in style, and printed on the fancy menu paper. But that's all right, it's all right, more or less. As long as you're able to float instead of sink to the bottom. Or maybe that's the real place to be, sunk low at the bottom, like those Riache bronze warriors, 24 centuries alone in the sea, while the world raged above. If those bronze warrior brothers from 450 BC have souls that sometimes come awake, like the great cult statues of Athena, of the saints, what would they think of the ugly, brutal, and ultimately dull world around them? When they were finally brought up from the inky deep and locked inside a museum. They went down in the time of Herodotus, the time of the oracles. Of Homer's epics performed at festivals of the arts of the muses still appearing in the flesh. Of the finest art and architecture and manufacture of all things. And they emerged in a post-atomic, post-space age landscape of pollution and plastic. The babble of the world's worries broadcast to all of us night and day. To worms in the place of men. I want to tell you the story I told to the people gathered down in the old ruins of the Hot Springs bathhouse last week. And the story starts with a couple of tales I'm going to read to you from the Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, published in 1911, and my favorite book of Halloween stories. Tales of the Uncanny. A Changeling Musician. A family at Dalby had an idiot child, and when he was 20 years old, he still sat by the fire just like a baby. A tailor came to the house to work on a day when all the folks were out cutting wheat, and the idiot was left with him. The tailor began to whistle as he sat on the table sewing, and the little idiot, sitting by the fire, said to him, "If you'll not tell anybody when they come in, I'll dance that tune for you." So the little fellow began to dance, and he could step it out splendidly. After this, he says to the tailor, "If you'll not tell anybody when they come in, I'll play the fiddle for you." And the tailor and the idiot spent a very enjoyable afternoon together. But before the family came in from the fields, the poor idiot, as usual, was sitting in a chair by the fire, a big baby who could hardly talk. When the mother came in, she happened to say to the tailor, "You've got a fine chap here," referring to the idiot boy. "Yes, indeed," said the tailor. "We've had a very fine afternoon together. But I think we had better make a good fire and put him on it." "Oh," cried the mother, "the poor child could never even walk." "Ah," replied the tailor, "but he can dance and play the fiddle too." And so the fire was made, but when the idiot saw that they were for putting him on it, he pulled from his pocket a ball, and this ball went rolling on ahead of him, and he, going out after it, was never seen again. After this strange story was finished, I asked Mrs. Moore where she had heard it, and she said, "I have heard this story ever since I was a girl. I knew the house and the family, and so did my mother. The family's name was Cubbin." A remarkable changeling story, testimony of James Cafferty, a farmer and fisherman born in Kirkpatrick 58 years ago. 40 to 50 years ago, between St. John's and Foxdale, a boy with whom I often played came to our house at nightfall to borrow some candles. And while he was on his way home across the hills, he suddenly saw a little boy and a little woman coming after him. If he ran, they ran. and all the time they gained upon him. Upon reaching home, he was speechless. His hands were altered, turned awry, and his feet also, and his fingernails had grown long in a minute. He remained that way for a week. My father went to the boy's mother and told her it wasn't Robbie at all that she saw. And when my father was for taking the tongs and burning the boy with a piece of glowing turf as a changeling test, the boy screamed awfully. Then my father persuaded the mother to send a messenger to a doctor in the north known for doing charms, to see if she might get Robbie back. As the messenger was returning, the mother stepped out of her house, and when she went in again, her own Robbie was there. As soon as Robbie came to himself all right, he said that a little woman and a little man had followed him, and that just as he got home, he was conscious of being taken away by them. But he did not know where they came from nor where they took him. He was unable to tell more than this. Robbie is alive yet, so far as I know. He is Robert Christian of Douglas. These strange tales, gathered from the green Celtic lands of Brittany, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, Cornwall, and in this case, the Isle of Man, have more than a passing connection to the dry desert hills of the Southern California desert and mountains along the Mexican border. They have a strong and lasting connection, in fact, to a landmark of that very place in the backcountry of southeastern San Diego County. Because this mystical scholar, Walter Evans Wentz, this honorary American member of William Butler Yeats' Celtic Revival and the person who introduced Tibetan Buddhism to the West through his 1927 publication of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, who added his mother's Welsh maiden name to his own to make him sound more Celtic, lived out his later years in the backcountry of East San Diego County, which he found to be, you won't be surprised to learn, a completely magical landscape. Walter Evans Wentz had been familiar with San Diego for a long time by then. It was theosophy, the mystic philosophy of Helena Blavatsky, that originally brought him to Point Loma, to the Theosophical Institute there, now occupied by the Point Loma Nazarene College. Theosophy was the original New Age movement, the original mix of spiritualism and Buddhism and yoga and supposedly secret pagan rites from the distant past. It was occult, it was Neoplatonist, it was ancient wisdom, mostly delivered by a group of interdimensional hidden masters who communicated with a Russian aristocrat, the aforementioned Helena Blavatsky, born in Ukraine and notorious as a spirit medium in New York City by the early 1870s. It was in Manhattan that she created her esoteric religion for Americans. It's when karma entered the English vocabulary, and by the 1890s there were more than 100 theosophist lodges. But the most important of these did not exist in our realm, although we could occasionally enter. That was the White Lodge, where the ancient masters preserve the knowledge of the ages and of the future. There was its opposite, too, the Black Lodge. All of this was part of the occult revival of the late 19th century, along with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and other offshoots of Freemasonry and social clubs claiming descent from the Knights Templar. Walter Evans Wentz, born in New Jersey, was entranced by these esoteric developments. He would travel to Egypt and connect with the ancient gods and goddesses there, as the Golden Dawn's Aleister Crowley would do in 1904. By which time, Evans Wentz had moved to a more exotic locale, San Diego, Loma Land. The Theosophical Lodge and College and Commune created by Catherine Tenchley, who bought the site for what was originally called the School for the Revival of the Lost Mysteries of Antiquity. By the time Walter arrived in 1902, there was a yoga school and a Greek-style temple and an open-air theater. From there, he went to Stanford and then on to his mystical and folkloric research in the Celtic lands in Egypt and India and Tibet and Nepal. A globe-trotting life of religious practice and folkloric anthropology that would come to an end with World War II. It was 1941 when he chose San Diego again, this time for his forever home. He had a modest room in a downtown San Diego hotel, the Keystone, on 6th Avenue. That was his official address. And the building was chosen for its proximity to the Central Library and the only vegetarian restaurant in town, the House of Nutrition. But he also spent a lot of time at a place he called Kuchama, what the maps call Tecate Peak. Elevation 3,883 feet above sea level. It's on the way to Hucumba Hot Springs along Highway 94 from San Diego, just across from Barrett Junction. Evans Wentz kept a mystic's cabin on the mountain, a simple structure of wood, room enough to sleep and meditate and read and write. The mountaintop had long been a sacred place for the Kumeyaay people, and Evans Wentz found most of the land held by real estate speculators, including his father, who had moved to La Mesa to partake in that main occupation of San Diego County's business community. In fact, that's what Evans Wentz did for a day job, too, just like his father. So Walter Evans Wentz purchased 3,000 acres of the mountain and surrounding brushland. If you have a Tecate beer can within sight tonight, that's the Holy Mountain on the beer can. All holy places, Evans Wentz wrote in 1942, in varying degrees have been made holy by that same occult power of mind to enhance the psychic character of the atom of matter. They are the ripened fruit of spirituality, the proof of thought's all-conquering and all-transforming supremacy. And Evans Wentz should know, he invented much of the supposed Kumeyaay religious significance of Tecate Peak through the same well-intended exaggeration and reinterpretation of obscure rituals and memory that colored his misunderstandings of Tibetan Buddhism. But mistakes go well with any enthusiasm, and we cannot fault Walter Evans Wentz for his love of the old mountain he called Puchama. He died in 1965, the year I was born. He spent his final months at the Self-Realization Fellowship in Encinitas, what the surfers call swamis. Walter had many close friends there, yogis and gurus and swamis he'd first known in India between the world wars. So along with the classic books that bear his name, the fairy faith in Celtic countries, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Walter Evans once added one more, Kuchama and Sacred Mountains. Finally published in 1989, but nearly finished at the time of his death at the ripe old age of 87 years. If you've read Paramahansa Yogananda's classic autobiography of a yogi, the book that set George Harrison and millions of other Westerners on a path of fascination with Vedic and Indian culture, you may remember the introduction to that famous work is written by the yogi's dear friend, Walter Evans Wentz, in which he wrote these words. To its illustrious author, whom I have had the pleasure of knowing both in India and America, may every reader render due appreciation and gratitude. His unusual life document is certainly one of the most revealing of the depths of the Hindu mind and heart, and of the spiritual wealth of India, ever to be published in the West. Happy Halloween time, friends. On Sunday, October 29, this Halloween weekend, I'm doing the first old-fashioned Desert Oracle Campfire Stories in Yucca Valley at the local pub, the Tiny Pony. This will happen out back with a campfire and everything at 8 p.m. But get there early if you want a seat. Or if you want to see. They've got good food from the kitchen and more spirits than Jack Skellington would know what to do with. I did stop by last night to figure out how we'd set it up, and I have to admit, the owner I was talking to seemed a little spooked regarding the enthusiastic reaction to doing this event there. So, be chill. There are no tickets. It's not a theater or anything. It's a neighborhood bar with a backyard patio. I'll have some books and stickers and back issues available if you want those things, and that'll be after the stories. Whatever you do, have a good Halloween weekend. Boyd, as Isaacs, and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio. Musical soundscapes on this program by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And I'm Ken Lane, your Desert Oracle, until I'm gone. And the next one is appointed by the senior partners. Sometimes, maybe 20 or 30 minutes away from home, you'll notice some random car on the highway, and that car will take the exact 7 turns you take because it's also going to your house. And you already know before she even gets out of the car. You already know before you open the physical or electronic letter that's either disturbingly brief or horrifically long. You know you should have stayed in the cave today, should have never left the temple grounds. I don't know what to call it, but I know it's a lot more frequent these days. Maybe it's a natural learned ability to figure out the likely result of two entities in a certain situation. Which way the wind blows. Maybe it's the realization that no single event or cluster of events, no matter the momentary outrage or delight or dread it causes, really matters much in the long run. That even in a supposed age of wonders, everything is pretty much expected and ultimately unsatisfying, which is why it will be quickly discarded for something else. Or maybe, unlike the so-called artificial intelligence, we are eventually smart enough to understand that there really are only a couple of outcomes possible for anything. Good night from the voice of the desert.